The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Now, we're joined by a man who himself is very familiar with building walls of a different kind, perhaps to Donald Trump. And he's also familiar with the ups and downs of the economy here. Hugh Wallace is an award-winning architect and founding partner of Douglas Wallace Consultants. His career journey has seen him set up a practice that employed at one stage 160 people. It imploded in the crash, but he's back after coming through those very dark days. And he's a familiar face on our screens, fronting shows such as RTÉ's Great House Revival, My Bungalow Bliss and Home of the Year. Hugh, you're very welcome to the show. We'll get to your own story shortly, but first, today it's all over the news, marks the end of the no-fault eviction ban, with thousands facing possible eviction. I know you're not the housing minister, but you're in the industry, you're very familiar with it. What do you think needs to happen to solve the housing problem?
Well, I think that we need to get on and build social and affordable housing. There's a number of roadblocks for that happening. I think the society, and we have to have a conversation with ourselves about what sustainability means. And sustainability means living in our towns and villages, but it also means high-rise apartments, long-term living in apartments. And we still haven't got our head around that as a nation. We still want the front garden, the back garden, and the two up, two down.
And there has to be a suite of solutions. And the government would say that they have put in place lots of different policies. And the big problem is it doesn't seem to be happening quickly enough. Are there things like, for example, later on, we're going to talk about people converting old buildings into houses, you know, whether it was a bank or a pub or something. And there are incentives around that. But do you think things like that could play a big part?
Huge. In my opinion, there's about 250,000 vacant properties in this country in various states of neglect and dereliction. But the impediment is actually building control. So you have a suite of regulations which revolve around new buildings, which are being shoehorned into our existing building stock, and it doesn't match. And therefore, a number of councils who are very proactive in doing CPO orders, looking at buildings and actually converting them to residential, meet a barrier when it comes to building control. And that has to be stopped. We have to have a derogation in relation to fire, access, sustainability, what level of energy is actually required in these buildings. Is it a C rating? Because in my opinion, it should be. You will never get these buildings, or it's with huge amounts of money.
Too much regulation.
Miles too much regulation. And regulation is the impediment to the releasing of our existing building
stock. But regulation
stock
is really important at the same time. All of
it has to be balanced. You can't use a set of regulations that are for new buildings and shoehorn them into our existing housing stock. Remember, the vast majority of our housing stock that's vacant is over 100 years old. And these are the very buildings that we need lived in. But you can't do that because of the building regulations.
With all of your years of experience through architecture and in the wider sector, when do you think we started to go wrong?
1970. When we sold the councils had no money and had to sell all their property. And, you know, it's very easy today to be in hindsight. But in 1970, there were 3.8 million people living in the country. Who would have foreseen that there was going to be 5 million? And so we haven't got our head around that there are 5 million people living in the country. And we're going, oh, why are there no houses? There aren't any houses because we haven't built any. It's simple, you know.
Talk about a problem a long time in the making. I want to get on to your own story, Hugh, and your own career and career path in architecture and in business. But first, you grew up in Dundrum in Dublin.
I did.
You once described it as growing up in a Protestant bubble.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, my family, I was a Protestant in the 60s and 70s. We bubbled. We went to Protestant schools. All our family were Protestant. They all married Protestant. They had Protestant children. You went to the Protestant Scouts. You went to the Protestant Bible class. You know, it was just, and And then I went to Sandford Park, and in Sandford Park was completely different because nobody knew what anybody was because it was such a liberal school and religion wasn't taught and there was nothing and it was just fabulous. And then I went to Bolton Street and there were all these Catholics and I thought, my God, there's an awful lot of them. Where did they all come from? Yeah. Do you know it? And I know that sounds perverse, but that's the way it was. So, you know, we've moved so fundamentally as a society in 50 years, so nobody knows what anybody was. The first thing you met anyone, you'd say, where did you go to school? Which actually meant, were you a Protestant or a Catholic? That was actually the question.
But that's quite a Dublin thing that I discovered when I went to college. Loads of people from Dublin would say, where did you go to school?
Well, it wasn't in Dublin. That's for different reasons. That's to see if you're a rugby head or not.
Well, growing up at that time, you paint a picture of it as quite a cosseted, but quite a comfortable existence. What was family life like in childhood?
Well, I was an only child, and I'd love to have had siblings, but I didn't. So my parents were supposedly middle class, but like we didn't have any money. But then nobody had any money. We were much better off than the vast majority, but nobody had any money. Like, you know, I was chatting to a taxi guy coming here, and he turned around and he said, I lived in a tenement. I was brought up in a tenement in number 5 Henrietta Street. So, you know, we think that everything was perfect in the past. It wasn't. Half of the houses in Ireland in the 1960s had no indoor toilet.
And your dad would have had a good, steady, solid job, but he had problems of his own.
He did. My dad, unfortunately, liked the drink, and that affected him. When I was 17, he stopped drinking, and unfortunately, I took it up. But my dad and my mum, it was in hindsight, looking back, you know, my mother was loyal to my father the entire their entire life, and particularly when he was drunk, or drinking, should I say. And so outside, to the world outside, everything was rosy. Inside, at home, it wasn't.
Were you very aware of that as a child?
Not really. I was aware of it, and it wasn't discussed. And I'd be sent off to bed while they were having a chat. But it wasn't really even discussed. Women's roles were very different. A woman had to put up with what they got. They couldn't walk out the door. And so, you know, again, it's quite interesting. If you talk to somebody under 40, you go, what are you talking about?
Was that a very tense atmosphere at home?
There was a background tension in the house. But it manifested itself in different ways. So my dad was a horticulturist, as well as being a writer director, and he grew dahlias, and he'd go to the shows. And so one day I was playing pirates, and I had a big sword and I chopped off some of his dahlias heads. And the show was on, this is on a Thursday, and the show was on a Saturday, and my mother went out with sellotape and sellotaped the dahlia heads back on so that she could tell him later, in a quieter moment, of the accident that had happened.
Did it work? Did he?
No. He didn't lose. My dad never lost his temper, but he was very annoyed because he couldn't win his cup at the dahlia show.
His own drinking, he ended up getting help and quit 17. His job or lost his job.
Oh, he hated his job. He was forced to be a managing director of a family company and just hated it. He wanted to be a carpenter. And when I was 17, he went into John of God's for 6 months, came out, new life, very lucky, and ended up being a carpentry teacher out in Sutton Park School and loved it. And then, unfortunately, my mum died when they all, you know, all that issue and angst had gone. My mum died. And my dad, it was a big knock to my dad not to have my mum, because they were so close and they genuinely had gone through thick and thin together, but they loved one another and they just didn't have enough time together, you know, and that was, you know, so I think that was very sad, and it's very sad.
School life, did you like school? Were you good at school? You became an architect. You must have been very bright.
No, I was thick.
You were thick.
I was thick. I was dyslexic, but sure, nobody knew what that was. That was another.
How can I
just ask, how can they create a word called dyslexia for dyslexics when we can't spell it? In the name of God.
But at what stage did you realise that you were dyslexic?
I was actually just before my mock leaving. My English teacher, Greg Collins, said, "You're dyslexic," and everyone went, "Gosh, that's new." And I went for 2 days, did did testing, and they said, "Yeah, he's dyslexic." And then I did a lot of my. The Department of Education didn't know what to do, but now they had a letter, so I did a lot of my exams orally, and out of that, I ended up with 5 honours.
And architecture had beckoned. Did you always want to be an architect?
Oh, from the age of 4. I wasn't going to be anything else. So
why was that? What was
I loved drawing. I think it's because I was dyslexic. So I couldn't write how I felt. So I drew how I felt. And I drew ships and I drew buildings and I loved Meccano and I loved Lego and, you know, all that side of my brain. Which is about spatial relationships, understanding of spacing, understanding of form and shape and size. And that, to me, is why so many people are in the creative industry are, in fact, dyslexic.
So you were very visually aware.
Yes.
You were drawn to the world of the visual from an early stage. And then you went on to become an architect.
I did.
And you set up your own firm.
Yeah, as I walked out the door of Bolton Street, Douglas Wallace was set up and we started doing a job for the Devereux family down in Wexford, a hotel. And then there was no work in the 80s in Ireland. And so we ended up doing interior design.
And the business really took off.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about 160 people at one
stage.
What kinds of contracts and what kind of clients did you
have? Oh, we did all the work for Irish Nationwide, 3 of the banks. We did pre-mark, Peter Marks, Brown Thomas, Debenhams, you name it, we did it.
And then 2008 happened.
Yeah, we all fell over a cliff. So on... While things had become dodgy in 2004, in 7, it actually just, going into December, it was all over.
And it was that sudden? Was it very apparent to
you? No,
you'd
seen
it
in the year. It was a slow car crash. The car crash lasted for another year and it was horrible and it was daily and it was disturbing and it was horrible because you had to let staff go and it was like a drip feed of who's next to go.
And what kind of impact did that have on you personally?
Personally, it was horrendous because I felt guilty that it was my fault. And so many businessmen felt the same. And to a certain extent, there wasn't, nobody was, it was our fault. And there was no relief. And people felt very guilty over this. And I felt very guilty. Unfortunately, I took to the drink. But I'd...
In a bad way?
Yeah, yeah. At that stage, it had consumed me. And really, I wasn't even a functioning alcoholic at that point. But
what is that? I mean, people talk about drinking and excessive drinking and drink problem and all of these sort of phrases that get knocked around. You still had a business to run. It was a
at that stage
shrinking business.
Yeah, it was out. I don't know if you could say it was. You couldn't say it was in control, but that wasn't really because of my drinking. It was out of control because of financial circumstances and clients didn't pay. Like at the time, Douglas Wallace went to the wall. We were owed 2.3 million, and none of that, or very little of that, ever got paid subsequently.
And how bad for you did the drinking get then?
I'd convinced myself at that point that it was all right to watch the Gilmore Girls on a Saturday morning for 4 hours in bed, just in time, because in my head I wasn't an alcoholic if I didn't drink before 1 o'clock. But I was sitting somewhere at 1 o'clock with the drink in my hand.
What about your partner?
Martin.
What's
well, Martin myself are together 36 years. And Martin is an amazing man because he supported me through thick and thin. And I'm sure he also was waking up some days and said, I can't continue. Like the emotional effect of drink on the people around you is much more devastating, funny enough, than the alcoholic. The alcoholic is making the choice.
How, Hugh, did you turn that around?
I was very drunk one night and I had a moment of clarity, and it was 11 o'clock at night, and or 10 o'clock, and I just had a moment of anger, sheer anger with myself and what I'd become and the people I'd affected. And I knew at that moment that I'd been given an absolute moment of clarity where I had a decision to make. So you can either drink and die or stop. And I knew I had to get to the doctor the next morning by 8 o'clock, because otherwise the man in the shoulder would have told me by 1 o'clock it was all right.
What was that moment of clarity like? What was it that was so transformative?
Sheer anger.
With yourself?
Yeah, but it manifested myself by being aggressive with Martin in the room. And that's not my personality. And I was horrified by that. And some weeks later, in fact, a lady in Northern Ireland had stabbed her best friend 20 times in a moment of anger, having consumed a bottle of vodka. And I could empathise with her. I could understand what happened and the level that that person had got to, because I was there. And I went to the doctor the next day and he said, I was 55, and he said, oh, you're an alcoholic. And I went, that's it. I know that I'm not being frivolous here, but I was going, you're the first person who ever said that to me. That's a relief. I said, I'm actually not going to die. The relief of knowing that I wasn't going to die.
No one had said it to you before.
No.
During that period of drinking.
Isn't that wild?
That was a first step. There are lots of steps along that journey. And I'm sure it's a very, very difficult one. But from a business point of view as well, the firm had gone into liquidation. You turned that around for yourself and you came back into business with Douglas Wallace Consultants.
Yeah, and it's great. And we have a practice that's 20 people. There are four other directors. We do lots of retail, hotels, very exciting stuff. And what I think is amazing is at this stage in my life, I'm over 40 years in the business. And now I go around towns and villages and I go, we've left our mark. And architects do leave their mark, and they have to be responsible for the marks we leave. Because I think when we walk around our towns and villages now, I don't think some of our architecture is actually the best. And
what's wrong with it?
It's, well...
Well, how long have you got? Right? It's going to be one of those.
Yeah, well, the issue with it is that buildings need to talk to us.
So when
you walk up and down the Georgian Street, the buildings talk to us. And they go, I'm nicely proportioned. Do you like the way I look? Am I offensive? And you go, no, I'm enjoying this. Whereas if you walk up Cork Street, you'll go, it's not a nice experience. You mightn't do it consciously, but that's what your brain is doing.
Are you saying that a lot of the modern architecture has a harshness rather than a warmth?
There's no
warmth.
Or
an incongruity with
surroundings? No, it's boring. It's actually boring. It just lands on the ground and you go, well, I don't particularly like that. And we have to look back as to why architecture is successful. And successful architecture is chaos, because our brain loves chaos. It loves investigating. It loves trying to sort things out. And that's what buildings should do when they arrive at the street.
You're very well known for lots of TV work, and the Home of the Year competition, you know, is one in particular.
Do you know who wins? I'm dying to know now on Tuesday. Do you know
no,
who wins?
I don't know.
Oh, God,
who wins.
I don't know. I thought you'd tell me.
No, far from it.
I'm gutted.
I'm as much in the dark as you are. But if you look at the programme, in the context of these absolutely amazing, wonderful houses, and people are looking in and they're saying, God, I'd love to have a house like that, or I wouldn't love to have a house like that, or then that house amazing. In the current environment, more and more people are watching and they're seeing the possibility of even owning their own home head off over the horizon, and they're seeing that it's not going to happen for them. Do you think there's an incongruity about that? It's sometimes people say it's just too much in this current climate.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I think, you know, at the end of the day, there's 1.5 million homes and we're living in them. There are a group of people who have been denied access to homes. But that isn't the responsibility of the people who have homes. And I think we have to have a balanced approach on these things. The issue is that the government have to deliver housing in the right location. And that's what they should have been doing over the past 40 years. They didn't do that. And if anyone thinks that our present housing solution will be fixed by either this government or the next government, you're absolutely not a chance. There will be one more million people in this country, and we haven't even found homes for the ones that are here. So the task ahead of us is huge. It's a task for society.
Okay. Well, I no doubt we're going to be talking about it for another while to come. But Hugh Wallace, architect and founding partner of Douglas Wallace Consultants, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you very much.